found it, the first one, I just sent him a message and I was like, what should I do? I don't, not comfortable taking anything. 16 of these pyramid structures, and I couldn't find any modern documentation of it. I was able to capture the only modern media that exists of many of these places, like the literal only modern media that exists, because nobody's going out there. Nobody's trekking these mountains to capture these sites. Up and down the coast and in these valleys, it was over 3,000 kilometers. I was by myself. Not always the safest decisions that were made. You'll just see ruins that are sitting there that are unexcavated. I got really good at identifying the remnants of ancient architecture. I focused particularly on sites and locations that did not have any location markers, any labels, nothing like that.
And so you see these incredible megalithic sites, and then you realize that actually they're aligned to the solstice and the equinox. Then you realize they're acoustically tuned. Then you realize that acoustic tuning does actually seem to have subtle influences on the brain and perturbing the brain. And when you get into, you know, quantum biophysics, you could say, okay, well, that's actually exciting the neurological microtubules and creating quantum coherence in your brain. Okay, but did they know that? Probably not, but they achieved it. Raul here, he brought down a laptop when we were in the courtyard of the Cosmic Summit. I think about 2 o'clock in the morning, everyone was having their after party in celebration. We're out there with Filippo Biondi, and, you know, we're all misbehaving, and Raul turns up with his laptop and he's like, hey, I really want to show you something, can you just sit down and I'll just, you know, get a few moments of your time. I was like, absolutely. So we sit down and he shows me that essentially what he's been doing is going around Peru and looking on Google Maps for interesting places that strike his fancy, and then just kind of heading out there and seeing what he finds. And what you found is some pretty interesting stuff, including an elongated skull, right?
Not just one. I've found a couple of them buried out in the desert. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, this whole thing started just using Google Earth, you know, so something that is available and accessible to anyone. I got really good at identifying the remnants of ancient architecture. And these, I focused particularly on sites and locations that did not have any location markers, any labels, nothing like that. And I was like, I can't find any documentation on these places. So I was out there on the last expedition. I mean, crossing rivers, almost getting stuck in the Ocucaje Desert. That was terrifying. I mean, I'm scaling mountains, and then where the skulls were, the Paracas Nazca region. And, you know, I would find out after the fact, this is the region where, you know, when people go to the museums, these are the places a lot of them are finding the skulls that are you now see on display.
So let's take it back. How did you start this adventure of kind of jumping from place to place in Peru? What kicked this off for you?
I mean, so my mother is Peruvian, and so I was born and raised going to Peru every year and a half or so, and my dad was American, and he was really adventurous. So, I mean, growing up, this is back when there was very little infrastructure in Peru, and so my dad would rent a car and we'd be driving up in the mountains, and you know, 6 inches to, you know, to your right is a several thousand foot drop, you know, and it's a one-way path on a mountain, and you got to find a way to pull over when a car is coming the other way. It's terrifying, but that was my dad. And so every time we were down there, we'd at least spend a week or two going out to look at ruins. And I remember my dad pointing out in some of the valleys, like, you see that mound right there? There's structure under that. And I was like, what do you mean? And the thing was, not a lot has been excavated in Peru. I will put that out there. And archaeologists are continuing to find stuff. It's in the news every month. Like, there's a new discovery. But there's just so many sites. And not enough money, not enough teams, not enough interest to excavate all these places. So as we're going around, I mean, you'll just see ruins that are sitting there that are unexcavated, and the main cathartic moment for me was when I was around 10 years old. I was at Machu Picchu, and you weren't regulated to like a little path or anything when, you know, 30 years ago. And so I was just wandering on the site. I found this little cave and I went into it and I saw something shiny in the wall and kind of took it out. And it was seashells in Machu Picchu. And I mean, I still have the home video. I'm like, Dad, look at this, the old Hi8 videos. And that just blew my mind. I mean, seashells at 8,000 feet. And so, that would fuel the next several decades of just really independent, in-depth, ancient history research. I wanted to be an official archaeologist growing up, but I chose a more independent path. And so that decades of research, I would learn about like the cataclysms that our world has faced, and trade networks, and all sorts of things. And then just to fast forward, my channel is in its infancy. It's been about a year and a half, and it started last Christmas. Christmas before last, where it was the day after Christmas, my family wasn't doing much, and I just looked on Google Earth for ruins around me. I found some known ones, but then I traced the valley further up into the Andes, and I started seeing all these what I thought was ancient architecture that didn't have any labels. So I was like, you know what, Ma, I told my mom and my sister and my aunt, I'm gonna go out for a couple hours. And so I drove out into the mountains, I hiked through these valleys, I met some locals who were living on the property who were just as friendly as can be, walking me around these sites, and it was ancient architecture. So I was like, all right, one for one. The next day I did it again with a different site. I was two for two. When I came back to the States, I started posting about it, and I kind of developed this methodology that I got really good at identifying these places. So last year I went on a 23 expedition where I went to 90 of these places that were unlabeled. And I mean, I drove up and down the coast and in these valleys. It was over 3,000 kilometers. I was by myself. Not always the safest decisions that were made, but 90 sites, and every single one was the ruins of ancient architecture. Every single so far to date, it's 100%.
When you say ancient architecture, obviously, like when it comes to Peru, there's definitely layers of what we consider ancient architecture, and then the mainstream will attribute essentially all of this to the work of the Inca. When you're finding these places, how many out of this 90 are we talking megalithic, precision carved type of architecture that you get in Peru versus the loose stoned, rough cut Inca work?
There were one or two sites. So on the coast, you're not really finding that type of megalithic architecture. You need to start going up into the Andes. And for the next expedition, I've identified a whole lot of sites that would appear to have, because I start, I'm going into records from the 1930s and the late 1800s of people writing down where these places might be. And so, but typically on the coast, because it was, I mean, it's all pre-Inca stuff. It's just, it tends to be the loose stone. It depends what area you're in. It'll either be like the loose small stones with mortar in between, and then there's the adobe structures. But the earliest ones on the coast are carved out of bedrock, and so those are the ones that interest me the most. Those are the ones that, when Tom Dillehey tested Huaca Prieta, that's dating back to 12,500 years ago, right at the time of the Younger Dryas impact. And so there are other sites, in my estimate, there have to be, if they get redated, that are going to date that far back. And on the coast, my money is on it being the ones that are carved out of the earth itself.
Yeah, that's the thing about Peru, right? Is like I said, you've got this very interesting kind of layer of various architectural styles that seem to be very different in terms of how advanced they are. So obviously you've got this loose, rough cut stone, and a lot of the Inca constructs that are still standing are evidently made from that very simple structure and engineering method. But then you have, like you said, this megalithic carving, and then the ones that are straight out of the bedrock. It's like three separate layers. The megalithic kind of like Sacsayhuaman and Ollantaytambo in these areas, but then there are other versions that are even older by the looks of it that are just clean cut right into the bedrock, correct?
Correct. Correct. And I would say the Incas were only around for 150 years ish, you know,
Right,
and so
right.
their empire was really built on the empires that preceded them. And so, you know, when you talk to the Quechua or the Aymara people that are down there's this idea of not only interpersonal reciprocity, but this reciprocity with the land. And what you start to notice, especially in Cuzco, is like when you go to Machu Picchu, you'll see the stones. And Sacsayhuaman, I mean, any of these places, where they're repurposing the landscape that is already there. And so
Yep.
it's like there'll be a stone wall attached to a huge boulder, you know, besides the other megalithic stones, but like an actual part of the mountain. And so it's this idea of building along with the earth, along with the landscape. And so, and that is. The Incas adopted that, you know. So this was being done prior to that, and like you said, then you'll see a lot of the other stones peppered alongside as filler or things like that.
Yeah, and I think one of the other striking examples, I mean, I haven't been out to Peru yet, and I'm hoping to go out next month, actually, around the 13th, because there's an active excavation of Sacsayhuaman taking place, and they're going under the wall, and they're finding that the wall just keeps on going down. They haven't found the bottom yet. Very interesting about how deep down into the earth Sacsayhuaman's foundations actually go, and whether or not, like many of these other ancient places, subterranean passageways and underground elements of the complex which might be revealed. And I was when I was in Malta for the pyramid conference for the Khafre pyramid team, they actually were saying that they were quite interested in joining forces with some of these groups out in Peru to do synthetic aperture radar scans of places like Sacsayhuaman. So I think we're in an interesting area of time where these you know, these new elements of archaeology are starting to come into the forefront, and maybe they could be utilized to show something. But you know, you have incredible scales of like this multi-ton engineering being shown, and then next to it you have, like I said, this very simple Inca stonework. But what I find very interesting about a lot of areas that I've seen in Peru, and this is what I hope to kind of document when I go out to Cusco and maybe some other areas, is a lot of the really large precision scale work shows evidence of massive destruction. I mean, Sacsayhuaman's pretty much standing. There are some breakages in that what is clearly anti-earthquake engineering. But around the area, you have huge debris fields. In other areas of Peru, you have these big debris fields where huge chunks of rock with precision cut staircases upside down. And it almost looks like whatever a lot of this megalithic construct was obliterated. Some of it managed to survive, some of it didn't. But then next to it, you have non-uniform, very simple mortar-using freestanding buildings that are just completely intact. And yet we're supposed to imagine that these happened at the same time from the same people. So how are they still standing when these huge, more impressive megaliths are essentially broken to pieces?
I mean, that points to a different era when this destruction happened. And like you're saying about it at Sacsayhuaman, I mean, I'm not a geologist, so I don't know this. I can't give you dates or anything like that. But I mean, depending on how far down that goes, I mean, we have to imagine how much time it takes for the earth to raise up that high. You know what I mean? And like these. And thank goodness they're still like constructed under the ground. They're going to be preserved the way they were, and God only knows how far deep it goes, you know. So, and with the new technologies from the pyramid project and stuff, I think that like once this can be easy as like point and click, and it gets substantiated from a variety of methods and a variety of sites, I mean it will be game changing, you know. Like it's just there's several sites on the coast that I explored that like I know for a fact because I had a local guide that I stumbled across, and he walked me out to the site, and he told me, you know, and I think 2 or 3 meters under the ground there is a bedrock carved bench that archaeologists dug up, and they documented it, but they recovered things up, I guess, for preservation. But it's like if that's there, and you typically when archaeologists go to these sites, you get and what kind of what they're doing in Sacsayhuaman right now, you get a test pit, you know, and so you document as much as you can, you get the information you can, you make more assumptions, and then a lot of times on the coast at least, your funding runs out, the season's over, you move on to the next thing, and so. only little pieces of these places have actually been excavated, you know? And so if there's technology that can penetrate through the ground like that and it becomes cheaper and more accessible, there's so much to still find, Jay.
Well, speaking of which, these elongated skulls, which are, you know, famous all around the world, especially concentrated in Peru. There's been a lot of excitement over the Nazca mummies that have been uncovered in this region and are being studied. A lot of skepticism over them. A good friend of mine, Jesse Michaels, went out there recently and did a fantastic documentary on, you know, the research and the scientific studies of those very strange tridactyl beings that have been preserved in, it's like diuretic earth or something like that. They're not actually mummified. They've been preserved in that very interesting variant of earth. These elongated skulls, I was making a post about this today, just saying that, you know, regardless of head binding practices, we know that we were doing this, but the question is why? Surely the question then has to be, what were we venerating? Why was this considered in some way sacred? And why was it so widely distributed around the world? But Peru is a specific use case for this because there's such a high concentration of them, such a high concentration, in fact, that you found some whilst exploring the wilds.
Yep. I think you bring up a good point because, I mean, you see it in Egypt with Akhenaten and the hieroglyphs and the elongated skulls. So exactly like you said, who or what were they venerating, you know? Also, like you said, Peru has one of the greatest concentrations of them. I mean, you go to some of the local museums there and it's just, you know, walls full of these elongated skulls. And I came across two or three just in the Nazca Desert. You know, I unfortunately, a lot of the places I went to were just, I mean, looted burial sites. So you just, as far as your eye can see, you're just seeing the remains of mummies that have been torn apart and skulls and bones and this stuff, artifacts, everything's just on the surface. And so I don't know if you want to go into the PowerPoint here.
Yeah, let's bring that up. Raul's got a PowerPoint where he's going to show you a lot of the places he's been to, including these elongated skulls that he's been finding. And what do you do when you find an elongated skull in the wild? Like, what did you do with that? You just leave
it? I mean, I had been in touch with Brian Forrester because I know he's in touch with a lot of the museums there. And when I found it, the first one, I just sent him a message and I was like, what should I do? I'm not comfortable taking anything, but I'm like, does a museum want this or what? And his response to me at the time was, you know, honestly, Raul, the museums are full of them and there's just not much interest for them in the local space. So, you know, I made a pinpoint on my map and I covered it up. You know, I left it there and, you know, eventually as the channel grows and my connections grow, I still have that. And, you know, I've provided a bunch of stuff to the Ministry of Culture on their website, some of these places that I think were truly undocumented. And so, I mean, we'll see if anything comes from that, but it's just kind of the reality of things down there. There's a lot out there that if the money was there to document, preserve, and study, we would learn a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not unlike a lot of other places like Egypt. I mean, certainly just kicking the sand around in the Giza Plateau and things just are underneath the sand, like bits of pottery, pieces of artifacts. It's incredible. And like a place like Peru, obviously with the dense jungle, all of the coverage that you can't actually access, it's extremely hard to penetrate through some of these areas to find what might be underneath. But if you've got your presentation, why don't you bring that up and people can have a little look at where you've been going in Peru and follow along.
So this is just an example. These poshmarks you see on the screen, those are all looting pits. Each one of those is a looting pit. And in this particular section, it's stretched for 8 full kilometers. I mean, just 8 kilometers of looting, which was just, I've never experienced anything like that. And so when you actually get on the ground there, this is what you end up seeing.
So I mean, you can just see the bones everywhere.
Everywhere. There's bones, there's cotton. It's heartbreaking and fascinating at the same time. This is what the mummies like are supposed to look like. This is from the Chachia Cemetery, which is a known necropolis that they found and have preserved, that, when you go visit Nazca, you can actually go to it and see the mummies the way they used to be. And so you can see the bodies were wrapped in this cotton and this rope and the textiles around it. And so this is how they were, actually supposed to be preserved. And then when you go to these looted sites, this is what you see.
Wow.
I mean, so that was a fully intact mummy. And the desert preserves things so well. The hair is still there. And I imagine that looters were looking for precious metals probably
Jewelry and
on the bodies. But I mean, just to see the stark contrast of how it was meant to be and then what's there from looting, it's tragic and so much is lost. And you also think that I've been wondering too, because one thing I love about posting the videos on the YouTube channel, you Pillars of the Past 101 for anybody out there.
Links are in the description box below, guys.
Awesome. In a lot of the comments make me think, which is awesome, which is what I love about like this community here. I'm like, what happened here for there to be so many burials?
Right.
Was it a battle? Did somebody lose? Or is it generational? And without getting, scientists out there to carbon date the bones and things, we won't ever know if it's a generational thing, how far back it goes, how deep things go. I mean, because I'm out there, I'm at this site in particular. This is in a whole bunch of dunes, and there's structure buried underneath. I'm seeing literal adobe bricks, creating chambers going into the earth, and Lord only knows how deep it goes.
Yeah, that's the thing, because I mean, at least from face value, looking at the site as it is right now, you can't see any tangible markers of it being an important burial or memorial site. There's nothing signal. It just looks like a mass grave.
Looks like a mass grave. And here in this middle part, you can see there's actual stones. And
Yeah, so there's some structure.
there's 100% structure. And actually, so what you end up finding, where my cursor is right now, that's thatch. And so that thatch comes from the reeds that grow in the closer to the riverbed in the valley. And so these cultures would take that thatch and put adobe mud in between them, use it for walls. Particularly, they used it for roofs a lot. And this is what I was finding a lot of this, where it looked like the roof of structures was broken into by these looters. And so if that's the roof, you can only assume it goes at least 6 feet or so down into the ground.
Right.
And there's no excavations happening. It's just unfortunate.
And was it in this area that you found some of these elongated skulls?
Yes, here is the first one.
So was this actually already in this little crater as it was
Yes.
found?
So
Interesting.
I thought it was a piece of pottery initially, and so like the white you see was fully exposed and sun-baked. And so when I go to these sites, my whole thing is document, not disturb.
Can you
That's one of my
zoom in a little bit?
yeah.
Nice.
My whole thing is to like document, not disturb. So if there's a piece of pottery or something or a textile that I want to capture, I want to take a good picture, so I'll brush it off, to take a picture, to try to create a 3D model of it, just so I have like a database of things. And ultimately, I would love to provide all this stuff to the Ministry of Culture too. Like these are your sites. This is your patrimony. This is, I mean, one of the things I can say for certain from the last expedition, I was able to capture the only modern media that exists of many of these places, like the literal only modern media that exists, because nobody's going out there. Nobody's trekking these mountains to capture these sites. I'm working on creating a database that can be accessible to everybody. I'm just one guy out here. I have my thoughts and theories, but there's so many researchers out there, so many academics that can piece these things together, and hopefully it could be advantageous to to really creating the proper narrative of our past. So this, it was there. I thought it was a piece of pottery, so I brushed away the side so I could take a picture of it. And then where it's a little bit darker, that was buried. So I moved it to take this picture, to take this video, and then I reburied it, after I talked to Brian.
That's a wild thing to just come across as you're walking through this ancient burial site.
This place, no Ministry of Culture designation.
No.
It's just out there.
Wow. So what do you think? What do you think this elongation of the cranium is all about?
Well, I do think that there's interesting work out there when it comes to the, I guess like the work Forrester has done and the different, the anatomy of the skull plates and stuff like that, not having one of the sutures. I don't know. You see every, 10 years or so, there's a new species that comes about in the record books. And, I'm just wondering why these things haven't been classified as a different kind of hominid.
Well, especially the ones that are lacking the vertical, the sagittal suture, right? Because like anything that is an adult skull that's lacking what is considered a critical element of cranial bone development in a child, you have to ask the question of whether or not that is in of itself its own subspecies, and this is just how they develop, because this should not be naturally happening. And I saw another example of this in Malta, in the Museum of Archaeology in Valletta, because there was a number of skulls, well, reportedly hundreds of elongated skulls discovered at the bottom of the subterranean chambers of the Hypogeum, which is a subterranean complex in Malta. And these ones are also lacking the sagittal suture. So, I mean, like we were saying before, there was certainly a veneration of this head size for whatever reason, and a desire to induce practices that would increase our heads to look like this. But these ones, the ones that actually lack the suture, would you lean towards this being perhaps what we were venerating?
I mean I would think so. It would, there's a reason that you're binding your child's head. You know what I mean? You don't just kind of, you don't just come up with that. And I think, as far as like the classification of some of those, I mean, that it's a different skull for the ones that lack the suture. It's a different skull formation. And I mean, I sit here and I see the news pop up and I'm like, there are classes of hominids that are being, discovered and named as new species with much less evidence, you know what I mean? So it's a little baffling. These ones, when I sent to Brian, he said the sutures were there, so this is probably
head binding.
As far as what they were doing, and you find it all over Peru too, because this isn't the only place. You go to places Huancavelica and even up in Cuzco, you'll see it too. And so, I wonder if the class of Inca, like the top Incas had this feature.
Right.
Right.
And so, well, it might tie into the whole kind of mythic first Inca, which were meant to be more like godlike beings.
So, and it's, but also just the density of these being on the coast. I mean, it almost seems like an entire population was practicing this. So, and as far as the Nazca mummies go, I'm abstaining for the time being, waiting for more research to, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating.
Did you check out out Jesse's video?
I did. Great video, and I love how he presented it. The authenticity of some of the people who are like working on it, like the science, the people studying it. I found, and I think I posted this in response on X somewhere. I found a bunch of. So what I love about making these videos is I go out in the field, I do this stuff, and then when I come back and I make the video, if I don't know enough about it, I'll go through academic papers and books and records from the 1920s on, and I was doing that recently and I found a couple of petroglyphs, and I know Jesse showed some of those, a couple of petroglyphs from vastly different regions in Peru that have the three fingers. He showed the tapestries and the textiles and some of the petroglyphs. But from what I found in my research, these were pictures from the 1930s that aren't, 300 kilometers away from Nazca. And I'm like, what's going on here? Was this, did this stretch a whole lot further?
Yeah, there are some depictions in Egypt as well of little three-fingered, three-toed beings.
It's very, very peculiar, man.
It's a time of revelations, it feels, in a lot of different ways, depending on what sector of the world you're looking at. There's a lot of disruption of the status quo, whether it be in geopolitics or history or science. It's just a very turbulent time and a shake-up of the foundations. And Peru, I don't know, man, Peru feels like such a strange intersecting apex between different things because of the archaeological superiority of this stonework that just baffles us in terms of this like anti-seismic, anti-earthquake looking structures and stonework. Then you have such a high concentration of this elongation of the skull practice and the ancient stories of the gods who built these incredible megalithic sites. And it just feels like Peru, much like Egypt actually, is one of these focal centers where something extremely powerful and profound was happening in our ancient past, perhaps way further back than we really give credit for right now. And maybe we're getting to a point where we're starting to connect some of these dots together, but it's a very shattered puzzle piece.
I think you worded that brilliantly. I agree with you. I think Peru was, you don't hear it said much, hear it said often,
No.
but it is a cradle of civilization. I mean, point blank, period. It is,
Yes.
I mean, for millennia, and like Tom Dillahaye's work and finding that Huaca Prieta goes back to, pre-cataclysm.
And a cradle of high civilization at that.
The interesting thing is about Peru specifically, because you'll find hieroglyphs in Egypt, you'll find in Sumer and Ur, you'll find writing and cuneiform. Peru, you don't have that. And that's, I mean, the Harvard is currently doing study like the quipus. There's records in the old Spanish chronicles that when they would take some of the natives over to Spain and have them in the court, the quipu kamayaks, the ones who could read the quipus, I mean, they were literally reading stories from these knots tied, and so, but unfortunately, I think there's only between 500 and I looked this up, I might be butchering this, but like between 500 and 1500 quipus left in the entire world because the Spanish ordered the burning of all of them and the killing of anybody who could read them. So, I mean, you don't have a civilization as advanced doing as much as the cultures here in Peru were without some form of communication,
Yeah, I mean no, but it's a good point and it is fascinating. I mean, regardless of the fact that the pyramids seem to lay bare of any sort of hieroglyphics and can certainly bring the question of who actually built that structure or those structures in Egypt, the use of language and the use of written language. In Peru, you really don't have this, do you? There's not symbols and language and writing and coding on the rocks of Sacsayhuaman. It's all bare. And the same with Ollantambo and these other areas. It's almost like the rock itself was the signature, like the way in which we're building this,
Well,
that's our
and it's
signature.
interesting too. I did a video on my channel. It needs an update. It was one of my early videos. There's some stuff I made early on where now kind of getting into the flow I have. I'm like, oh, I should re-edit these. But
Trust me, if I go back 4 years on my own platform, I'm like,
yeah, right. I'm right there with you, man. But there is this fascinating research by Helmut Tribuch. He was the, I don't know, not a physicist, but a very academic title at the Free Germany of Berlin. He did a paper, and it's a peer-reviewed publication on how the stones were built, and it makes sense to me. So the Incas and even the pre-Inca, like when you're mining, right? And they were mining for resources. You end up, this is the theory, I'm repeating it, but there's an academic paper out there. I'll send it to you. You can link it in the description if you want. But one of the byproducts of mining is this like sulfuric acid, it's mixture type of thing, and it is known to melt stone when applied. It's like a paste, like a red paste. And you know, you go back and you look at the accounts of Percy Fawcett and Hiram Bingham. They both independently of each other have stories in their journals of seeing, as weird as it sounds, seeing a bird with a red leaf. And like the bird would take this red leaf and put it on a rock and peck at it. And eventually the substance from the leaf would kind of like melt the rock. This is, I mean, Percy Fawcett documented it on three separate occasions. And like
Oh,
these red.
I'm pretty sure there's actually some indigenous stories of the use of sacred plants to soften stone, so
Yep. And
it kind of tracks.
so the what this guy Helmut Tribuch's research did is he goes through all those, you know, Spanish chronicle accounts and indigenous accounts. Says that plant, what it does is it I'm not a chemist, so I might be butchering this, but it furthers the oxidation of the minerals in the so you're mixing that acid with this red plant, so you're getting this reddish brown substance. You mix it on the rocks and it kind of softens the stone. And when you go to Sacsayhuaman, when you go to Cusco and you look in, and people have done this, I mean it's all over the internet, if you look in between the seams of these stones, you see this reddish hue, you know, like there was some paste to it. And I mean, it makes sense to me. It would, you know, sometimes I think it's just like the easiest, most visible solution that even a child, when they go and look at things, can oftentimes be the most accurate. Like it looks like they
Right,
just press those
right.
things together like marshmallows, you know? So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Amazon basin is attributed to essentially a biotechnology called ayahuasca. Incredibly hard to actually synthesize unless you have the knowledge of being able to inhibit your acids in your stomach, which they were able to figure out through plant chemistry, marrying the correct vine with the correct branch, with the correct bark, sorry, to inhibit your acids and allow for the DMT experience. So I would say that there is a sophisticated botanical science in Peru and within the Amazon basin that the West has just completely ignored and laughed away for a long time. So I'm certainly not against the idea that some avatar style connection to Earth and knowledge of different plants and chemistries of plants would enable you to have these very novel toolkits that we just assume couldn't be done. So I'm very much open to that as an idea. And I, like I said, I'm pretty sure during my research that there were some Andean shaman stories of using a plant, a sacred plant, to be able to construct these things. Another thing's the lifting, though, right? Like, high altitude. This is another thing, right? We're not talking flat plateaus. We're talking the Andes. We're talking high mountainous regions, extremely high altitude, and they were lifting multi-ton stones. Like, how do you think they were doing that?
I mean, I think you know, it's funny too, because like when you go to Ollantaytambo and you go on one of the classic, you know, tours, when I went on this last expedition, you know, you're told the story of how National Geographic in 2007 recreated from one of the quarries and hauled this thing over the mountains. And I mean, yes, it's possible. Personally, I think people were much more in tune with the energies of the earth back then. I mean, hell, we live in a modern society where, I mean, even my attention span, I mean, I can't remember, you know, and it's like part of me can't even help it. I'm just so inundated with information all the time. I mean, back even when Percy Fawcett and Hiram Bingham were exploring in, you know, the 1900s, you're much more aware of things. You're much more aware of your surroundings. You're paying attention more. So they were able to see this bird because they're, you know, do the, and then you go even further back. You go millennia back, and you have what else are you doing besides watching the stars and
Exactly.
watching nature and understanding and experimenting? Like, you have the time, the energy, the interest, the curiosity to do these things, you know? And which I feel like we've lost touch with in a big way. And so I've always been pulled towards, like Native American ceremonies and these shamanic ceremonies that really kind of try to put you back in touch with these earth energies. And I mean, hell, even Tesla,
Yeah.
was, using the magnetics of the earth, and these are things we've lost touch with in this consumer technological age. We can, it kind of feels like we had a choice at some point to go in one direction or a different direction, and we chose this gas energy burning, profit making pathway, and there was this completely alternative one that I believe the ancients were much more in touch with, and we have just lost our connection to it.
Yeah, I well said, and I agree, and I do think that that likely does extend back into the Younger Dryas period, that there were, previous rises and falls of civilizations before our own written history began, and that we still have some of the remnants of these that we misidentify and attribute to, like, the Neolithic or the Stone Age, when they are most likely much further back in time. And I wonder, man, like, because I agree with you, it seems like there was a much more holistic connection to the earth, not just in a hunter-gatherer, survival with one and nature way, but actually quite a profound and almost borderline technological way of understanding the energetic lines that go through the planet, the connection points that will, align with astronomy and the phases of certain cycles in our solar system. This is all stuff that's incorporated into a lot of these prehistoric, megalithic, multi-ton stone building sites. And another thing that I find very interesting that's also a global signature is acoustic engineering and the deliberate engineering of these places for acoustic resonance and vibration, which, like you said, with Nikola Tesla, if you want to understand the secrets of the universe, think in terms of resonance, vibration, and energy. That's a quote from him. And I think that that is absolutely true. And I have a feeling, because you think of someone like Tesla and many others within science, they're intuitive scientists. Brilliant, but they bring that information from a place that we can't really quantify and understand. And a lot of the time we laugh at those people, and then 100 years later we venerate them for being the best of their field, right? And I think that if you're dealing with a culture or a people that is so intuitive, so purely connected to the planetary energies, to the cosmic energies, to the flow and ebb of reality, intuitive information is going to start flowing through you in ways that is quite counter or contradictory, I should say, not counter, contradictory to what we would understand. And so you see these incredible megalithic sites, and then you realize that actually they're aligned to the solstice and the equinox. Then you realize they're acoustically tuned. Then you realize that that acoustic tuning does actually seem to have subtle influences on the brain and perturbing the brain. And when you get into, quantum biophysics, you could say, okay, well, that's actually exciting the neurological microtubules and creating quantum coherence in your brain. Okay, but did they know that? Probably not, but they achieved it.
They
They achieved
achieve.
it. And that's the point, is that intuition beats empiricism to the door. It might not have the evidence for it, but it beats it.
And it needs to be cultivated. I mean, I think, I mean, I literally, I'm on the last expedition, so I'm going to these places. And I mean, when you go, man, I mean, especially to some of these sacred sites. And what's awesome is, like, I had to find, I found myself pausing often because I was, I was there on a mission to document things, and so I got the GoPro on my head and I'm all excited, but I was like, take a moment, take a moment to just be here, and that's when I would have, like, just these intuitive, just walk this way, go that way, go look over there, and that's, and I would find things. But when you go to these sites, I mean, it's, people talk about it all the time. It's not just the majesty of these places. There is a literal resonant frequency that is, beyond our senses, that you just experience at these places. And sometimes you don't, it's better when you're not looking for it and you just get hit with it. I mean, there are, I remember when I was a kid, we went to this place called Markowassee, which is, really high up in the mountains, and that's where, you know, a lot of the native. Peru is also weirdly like a hot spot for UFO activity, and I mean, so much so that when you drive down the Pan American Highway and you see all these stands with ice cream, it's called Omni ice cream, and Omni is UFO in Spanish.
And it, but it's also pretty widely accepted as just like it's a thing,
It
right?
just
Whereas in the
happens.
West, it's kind of like, oh, we don't believe in this. But in you go to South America and other areas, like, of course it's real. Of course it's real.
One out of three people have had
Yeah,
an
right.
experience. I personally haven't had any. Like, I'm like, please show me something. You know what I mean? When I go down there. But yes, it is part of the culture. And so this place, Marcahuasi, that we went to, it's the energy is different, man. You feel lighter, and there's these weird stone formations, and like something different happens with the energy. And then you go to Pumapunku, and you see people taking
Oh
a
man,
compass to some of these stones, and it's
yeah.
making the compass go wild. They were on to something that we have lost touch with.
Yeah, I mean, Pumapunku is such a great example. I did a little video covering that in my latest video, just on megalithic structures around the world that seem to be attributed to giants by the ancients, and Pumapunku is another one. And you know, this is just such a incredible site, and also one that seems to be vastly unexcavated. They've done a tiny bit of excavation and just gone, yeah, that's it. It's done now. We don't need to look any further. And it's like, this place is incredible. The H blocks, these precision carved H blocks that seem to fit together like jigsaw pieces. I don't think we have any clue what was really being done over at Pumapunku.
No, and I think that it's funny. I made a little Instagram reel on this. So when you ask a lot of people, when in this space, you know, will say when the natives were asked who built this, you know, when the Spanish asked the natives who built this, the natives respond saying, "We don't know. It was already there." Well, that actually comes from Garcia de Leon's book, and that's when he asked the natives in Tiwanaku who built this, and they said, "We don't know, it was here." And when he asked the natives in Cusco who built this, they said, "We built it in imitation of Tiwanaku." So I'm wondering, how deep does the stuff at Tiwanaku go?
Right.
Because if the and there's a part of me that's like, all right, the Inca, you know, taking credit for such, you know, we built this in imitation of these guys, you know, it's very possible that was already there too, you know, and they just added their
Yeah.
stuff. But
Well, I struggle with the toolkit that's attributed to the Inca versus the stonework that's being done, right?
yeah, I mean that. I mean, some of this stuff is just it looks so. It's some of the like the imperial stonework that is, you know, these. It's like log houses made of polished stone that just are
Right.
so fit so
Like
precisely.
seamless. It's
And I
incredible.
think Dr. Barnhart has done. He's been trying to do some research on this for a while now, but people have looked closely at those seams, and it almost looks like there is some sort of, I might be phrasing this wrong, but a chemical connection between one stone and the other other stone. Like you can see the molecules or something. There are hundreds of lost cities in the Amazon that just
So many.
and of stone, not just like the earthworks that they're finding. And you're going to find the stone closer to like as the Andes start going down into the Amazon basin.
Yeah.
But that's where the Inca fled when the Spanish were, you know, raising hell in Cusco. They documented, you know, some of the ruling class went, and that's where they thought that some of them were going to Paititi and these other lost cities. Like they went on certain paths into the jungles that the Spanish couldn't follow. They were clearly going somewhere. And so there's going to be places that are found in our lifetime.
And like one thing I'm excited about just for visiting Cusco is the fact that you've got so much of this megalithic architecture just kind of incorporated into the city itself, right? So there's so many areas of Cusco walking around this more modernized city where you'll just see half of the building is made out of this incredible precision work from the ancient times.
You say that too, because kind of think that's what the Incas were doing too, and we just did it with the Inca stuff, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like
you want evidence that we do this kind of shit, just look what we did to the Inca and the previous work with the modern stuff, and that's exactly what they were doing with this megalithic work, 100%, you know. And like, there's some really obvious elements of that, you know, especially around like Machu Picchu and areas where you can just see that they've tried to fix what was crumbling down from the megalithic construct.
You'll see that at Ollantaytambo a lot. When you get up yeah. to the very, very top on the left side, if you look around, you'll see these huge megalithic stones that must have come apart in an earthquake or a cataclysm at some point. And then you have like these little filler stones trying to keep it all together.
Mm. What do you think of the nubs? Because these are another thing that you get everywhere. And in the Ollantaytambo, I'm not pronouncing that right. I'm murdering it. I'm terrible at pronouncing that. You get these nubs, don't you? These little protrusions, and you know, some people say it's for holding up the rocks, but they're not on every rock. They're very strange little things. What do you think about them?
That's why I'm interested to see how deep down some of this stuff goes.
Right,
because,
right.
When you go to Cuzco, what they will tell you is some of the nubs were, and some of them do make sense, but they're formed a little differently. For the thatched roofs that they used to have, so like it would be the thing to, you know, tie like a patio roof, the thing you're tying on to hold the roof in place. You know, this is my personal theory. Some of the stones have the nubs, other stones have indentations, right? So like there's a chunk taken out of some of the stones and others have the nubs. So part of me wonders if these stones were together and the one with the nub kind of pulled out of this other one, if that makes sense.
So things like this, right?
Yeah, there they go.
These ones here are very interesting.
And they're all over. I mean, with the modern explanation of them is the ones that have the indentations were used to hold, you know, sticks so they could lift the stones and put them in place. It's a mystery.
And then you get these ones. So this is in Menkaure Pyramid in Egypt, where you get the same kind of nubs appearing. I was out there filming these as well, because this is very interesting. The stonework here is very cyclopean, almost reminiscent of somewhere like Sacsayhuaman. And then they would like smooth these down to a fine filing, but before they were done, they had this cyclopean look, and they had these nubs. And again, this is one of those signatures that you just seem to find all over the ancient prehistoric megalithic world, are these weird nubs. And they're not always in positions that would be intuitive. Like for example here, like why aren't they on this side of the wall, but they are on this side of the wall? Like, you know, it's like these little mysteries that mean you can't fully definitively say, oh, it was hoisting, it was for attaching, because it's not on every place where you'd expect that to be the case. So it's a very strange phenomenon.
I wonder if some of the ones that they're going to find underneath the ground when they're doing these excavations are going to have them.
Well, I'm definitely very interested in seeing just how far they can really get with the excavations around Sacsayhuaman. And I'm also really happy to see it happening, just because, you know, you look at somewhere like the Giza Plateau, where we so desperately need to be trying to get into these subterranean areas, and there is just locked gates, locked doors, no grants being given, no outsiders allowed to do any sort of work. It's all being done very officially through, you know, the scan project via Zahi Hawass. And it's refreshing to see that there actually are some boots on the ground excavations happening around an important site like Sacsayhuaman, because finding out if there are these subterranean elements to it, I mean, it's just another hallmark of these extremely ancient places, is that there are things to be found below the ground. Chavín de Huanta, another area where you've got, you know, this incredible temple built above ground, but underneath it you have this labyrinth, and that labyrinth is another one that has this acoustic engineering. They've even found the infrasound propagates through it, and I believe that when they were originally doing the excavations around that area, they found conch shells that had actually been purposefully engraved to alter the harmonic through the conch shell. So definitely a signifier of ritual acoustics.
So it's funny, because when you talk about that, it makes me think of some of the oldest structures in Peru. The oldest stone temple pyramids are found on the coast in the Caralsupe region. Now they're finding older stuff in the Casma region, which is just fascinating. They found these circular plazas. So one of the staples of these cultures on the coast was these massive pyramid structures, and in front of them was this sunken circular plaza. And what they found at, because this was a pre-ceramic culture, but they did find bones that were animal bones that were made out to be flutes. And they also found conch shells and things like that. And so the acoustic properties of those circular plazas, there's something unique about those. I don't know that a ton of research, I've seen a few peppered researchers out there talking about this stuff. But even that, I mean, so it's like back then, 5,000 years ago, they were doing stuff with acoustics that we still haven't put our finger on.
And acoustics, I just feel like acoustics play such a significant role. Like you said, haven't put our finger on. We're only really just starting to realize the effect of acoustics on the brain. A lot of people have heard of things like binaural beats or binaural tones, and institutes like the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences, where they're doing acoustic work. But this is a fledgling science that we're only just starting to realize can have very deep effects on our neurology, and even potentially as we get into the quantum biophysics of how our body and how our brain reacts with the quantum environment, how acoustics could influence non-local consciousness states that are more quantum in their effect, meaning that, you get intuitive downloads or access to what we might call the Akashic records, or what we might call the unified field, depending on which way you want to look at it, spirit or science. They are the same thing. And I think that the archaic mysticism is going to end up being, weirdly enough, proven through frontier science. The deeper we get down into this quantum world, the spookier it gets, the more mystical, the more supernatural the feelings are. And I mean, it was Albert Einstein that called it spooky action at a distance, this idea that quantum particles can be affected from one point of time to the other. You change the spin of an electron and its pair electron will change, even if it's on the other side of the universe. So there's something to be said about this, and I think acoustics ties very deeply in. And I'm sure you've heard of cymatics, like the geometries of acoustics, right? So, this is another fascinating thing that you just see once you start looking at what kind of geometries are produced by sending fundamental frequencies through a sand plate, and you see the sand start to reorganize into these geometric structures. Once you start looking at all of the various examples of that, and then you go into a temple or a church or a cathedral, and you see the exact same geometries, not just in the architecture itself, but in the motifs, in the glass, the designs. It is a sacred language of sound and science that has been put into our theological architecture almost quietly. You won't know unless you really know. But once you know, you look at these areas and you realize that it's actually about acoustic induction into the spiritual realm. I think that's what it's about. Whatever you might consider the spiritual realm to be, acoustics and the propagation of it in a sound chamber with a whole group of people chanting together, it changes the brain.
And I think you, I mean, dude, you go on Groupon nowadays or something, and you see discounts for sound baths, and so it is, and where people will sit, and the sound bowls and things like that. I mean, we are organic spiritual beings, so the fact that we wouldn't be affected by these things. I mean, I haven't been to Egypt, but in some of these like chambers in Peru, when you talk and the echo and the reverberations that happen, you feel it. You know what I mean? You feel it in your body. And so to think that there is not some sort of physio spiritual connection. I think you're right. I think that as things progress, we're coming to this this more connected place where science and spirituality will kind of meet. And I think, I mean, it's like with the ancient mystery schools and stuff. I mean, that's what they were talking about, the harmonics and resonance and Pythagoras and pre-Pythagoras, and how there is this connection to these things, and it's almost like you are catapulted into this next realm, whether it's the Akashic records or just the collective unconscious, where then you can start to have these downloads and whatnot. Where if you can trigger that, and sometimes it's through psychedelics and drugs, but there are other ways to do it through the senses, and that would be through sound and visual stuff.
I think that's what they were doing. I think a lot of these ancient cultures were triggering these types of downloads and insights. And again, it comes through the lens of their own spiritual practice and like an intuitive desire to, you know, propagate these tones or these chants that they believe are powerful. But once you fast forward to our time and you look back, you realize that some of the effects that might be taking place inside these ancient structures are effects that we're studying in biophysics and quantum biophysics today. And that's why we need to recognize it. Again, it comes to that whole thing of intuition beating empiricism to the door, because we need both. You need both. But empiricism requires you to chip away at the bedrock of reality, observe the environment, what I can see, what I can think, what I can feel, and start to slowly take it apart. And that's what science does, and it's great. But intuition goes right through the atoms, right through the protons and the electrons, right down into the Akashic field, right down into the unified field, whatever you want to call it. And so you actually have this ability, almost like an antenna, to draw this information up very easily. Unfortunately, you don't come with empirical evidence. You just have a strong intuition and a knowing. But hundreds of years later, that knowing gets validated by the same people that were laughing at you for saying these things. And that is where we're at right now, I think. And I think that this realization is something that, for example, Terence McKenna, one of my favorite thinkers of all time, would call the archaic revival, this revival of ancient knowledge, of mystic knowledge, but through the lens of modern science, through an explainable framework that makes sense to us in modern times. And I think that we're on a very strange transition point in a lot of ways, you know, with AI and virtual reality and quantum computation. We're right on the edge of something that does feel spiritual, but very scientific.
And I think that's the only way that we will, because you have people on a complete one side, you know, that very in tune with the spiritual intuition stuff, but there's, you know, you can't quantify it. Then you have this academic side that it's all about quantifying things. And so it is the perfect blending. And I do think a lot of it is going to – so it's just when some of this stuff about the past is so easily dismissed, it's like maybe look there. Maybe look there for some of the answers you're looking for and with an open mind, and you might receive some of this stuff. I mean, I think it's a funny quote. I don't know how I came across it, but it was like, I don't know, Michael Jackson at some point called his producer at 3 a.m. He had a dream or something, and like a song played in his head, and he was like, "We need to get in the studio now and record this." And the producer was like, why do we need to do it now? He said, "If I don't do it, God's going to give it to Prince." And so it's like...
That's great.
So you talk about tapping into something.
Do we know what song that was?
I don't, but I did trace it at some point. It is kind of documented somewhere. I might have butchered the exact wording, but, you know, it's like... tapping into whatever Tesla was tapping into. And
like that idea is floating around in the sphere. Someone's gonna take it if it's not you.
It's happened to me several times too, where I'm like, I have an idea to do something, and I mean, it's because we're all connected, you know, and we're all tapped into something greater than us, and it's my firm belief that if it's meant to come about, it's going to find a way through that unconscious to come about, whether I'm the channel, whether somebody else is the channel. If it's the time for it to come about, it's going to find a way, like water. It's going to find the path through.
Exactly. Exactly.
This here, though.
Hmm.
I mean, this site, this is from Google Earth on the left here. It stretched for almost a full mile, half mile, full mile.
Wow.
That's all structure. These are massive walls. And so I went there, and I mean, now a lot of it is crumbled. And a lot of times you go to these places and you don't even know you're standing in the middle of a structure until you put the drone up in the air. But there was this here, and this is on the coast.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so we're starting to increase the block size a little here.
And so this was the only wall I found, and I only explored a portion of it. So I want to go back and find other structures at the site that look like this, because right now I've spoken to a geologist. I've spoken to one geologist that said it's natural. I've spoken to another geologist that said it might not be natural.
I don't know. That doesn't look very natural to me.
No, it doesn't. I mean, the way these stones kind of curve and connect.
Yeah. I mean, I know you can get geological formations similar to this, but that looks like wall work.
It does. And so, before I personally, attribute any claim one way or the other, I'm like, you know what? This was the only little strip I found it at that site.
Right.
I'm like, I got to go back to the site and find something else to kind of
Yeah,
corroborate that.
definitely, definitely.
That's just kind of how I approach these things. So, I mean, that's one of the most interesting sites. And then there was this other site, Purulen, which, so this is all from Google Earth,
Oh, wow. Wow, you can see the geometry.
right? And so this is, there were like 16 of these pyramid structures, and I couldn't find any modern documentation of it. So I went, it's
Wow.
a hell of a journey.
And I'm so you
This is
haven't been,
what
have you
they,
been? Oh, you've been there. You have been there. Interesting.
yeah, I did. Yeah, this was one of the primary places I wanted to get to. So these are pyramid structures, and through research, this is what I love about the channel too, the community that comes from it. An archaeologist reached out to me and said, I think this is the site of Purulen. And he sent me somebody's dissertation, and I looked at that dissertation. I found a citation that linked me to the original survey of this site, which was from 1970. That's the only time work's been done at it. 1970, there was a survey done.
Wow.
And in that survey, Walter Alva says, I think this is from 1800 BCE, but it's likely that it dates back a lot older. This is like I will make it a mission that eventually, when I have the funding and the connections and the resources, that we go back to this site and start carbon dating things we can. This is carved out of the bedrock, so it is, and it's right on the coast too. Like you see the ocean in the background.
Well, what's incredible as well is just how easy it is to deceive from the boots on the ground. Like you see that aerial view and you can clearly see those geometries coming out of the landscape. But when you're down on that ground, it's very difficult to make out the same structures. It just goes to show that, sometimes it's the perception and the perspective that we have, and we can just be walking right on top of things without knowing it.
It's happened to me so many
Yeah,
times down
exactly,
there.
right.
I mean, I literally walked up to the first one here, and like my heart sank a little. I was like, is this a pyramid? Because it looks so precise from Google Earth. And
Right.
I also though had to realize these structures being right on the coast, the erosion that has happened to them is more extreme than anywhere else, because it's been in this area of Peru has been inundated by tsunamis, massive El Nino events, cataclysms. I mean, it is, and it's, I could barely get the drone up in the air because of the wind. It is, the erosion is accelerated right there. So,
Right.
Lord only knows how far back these things date. There's a
Has there been
little.
much work around the coastline in terms of underwater and anything being found?
You know what? That's an interesting question. I don't know the
Yeah.
answer to that.
Yeah, well,
That
I
is an
don't know
interesting
either. I
question.
mean, has there been much diving around these areas in terms of megalithic submerged sites? Because I feel like there could be some stuff.
There could be. That's. I'll have to look into that, man.
Yeah.
That is. That's an
Never
interesting
know,
thing
right?
to bring
Never
up. Yeah.
know.
No. Definitely not. I mean, it, and it's. I mean, it's worth investing. This was a cradle of civilization. This is one of the drone shots of this. I mean, that's a pyramid.
Okay, yeah, now that you can see that a lot clearer, a lot more clearly from the air. It's incredible how the perception changes.
And so the reason I knew these had to be pyramid structures is because you see they're
Oh,
all
you could, yeah, you
oriented
could,
facing.
yeah.
And so most of these early cultures were building structures facing north northeast, so to align on the June solstice when the sun rises. And every single thing built at this site was built facing that direction. So I
Come
was like,
on, man.
this is ancient architecture.
Yeah. Wow.
So I mean, that's
How far out into the sticks is this in terms of civilization and like a, getting out to
I
these
mean.
places?
Walter Alva is the archaeologist who did the initial survey, and he said it's a place he always wanted to get back to. It's just hard to get to,
Yeah, it looks it. It looks it. Gradient doesn't look fun.
But I'll tell you what, man. We talked about like the intuition stuff. I've been hesitant to say things like this just because it is more of an intuitive feeling and just more of a personal experience. It could be, I always want to leave room that my mind is making things up. But when you go to these places, when I went to this place in particular, as I'm walking there, that hour and 45 minutes it took to, the whole journey is on YouTube. I was like, I feel like this was a pilgrimage site. I feel like this was a place of veneration that people would come to. And it's just a feeling I had walking these paths, feeling like this is the paths that the ancient people used to walk. And because you don't really find, and also I think there was some stuff in the survey that kind of verified that idea. You're not finding massive amounts of pottery, which also might make it pre-ceramic. But you're not finding housing. You're not finding, like, so it was like, why are they building these pyramids if there's nobody actually, like, living there? So that's the feeling I got there. This is the, I mean, to get into some of the more, we've all heard, like, the Göbekli Tepe stuff and sites kind of being.
Yes, I remember you posting about this. Tell people what they're seeing here.
So, on the left-hand side, this is from 20 satellite imagery from 2017. You can see this is all ancient architecture. And then from 2024, it's literally been paved over. There's now an agricultural farm. When I went in 2024, I mean, this is what this section looks like, and it used to
That's just
have
crazy.
ancient. But now, when I went, I made a video on this. This whole back section here that was ancient. When I went, I guess just a few months after the satellite image was taken, this whole upper section was gone.
Oh my
Just
God.
gone. And so, and this isn't, dude, this is.
Look at this.
And I only found this stuff by mistake. So
Oh
when I'm
my
using
God.
Google Earth, I'll roll the satellite imagery date back so I can, sometimes it just helps me to make out structures. And so this was all by happenstance that I saw there used to be structure here. And it's just a matter of time until it's all gone. And these places aren't being, I mean, here, this was some sort of temple here on this side, and now it's all agriculture. This
I mean,
isn't.
why is who's in control of making these decisions? And is there not like a Ministry of Antiquities that would protect these places?
There is, this isn't low. So a couple of things. This isn't local farming. This isn't like just, which my heart would go out to if it was like the local indigenous population. Like this is,
Right, just trying to survive and trying to get
but this is
by.
corporate. And the unfortunate thing is, at these sites, there was no Ministry of Culture designation. I mean, the Ministry of Culture is in Lima, and they're doing a lot of archaeological work. There are, but there are just it. It's, I personally think they could be doing a whole hell of a lot better. But there's just so many sites that to send people out to them to keep tabs on them. And I had this idea in one of my earlier videos earlier this year, like, why don't you pay a local to keep an eye on things? And when he sees bulldozer, he or she sees bulldozers coming in, make a call to the Ministry of Culture. That was a novel idea, but the reality is these corporations, things can get very violent very quickly in Peru. And so,
Well, there's a lot of cartel presence
and the
and
cartel have their hands in so much down there, man. And so it's like these land mafias that literally, I mean, I made videos on this. One of Peru's most prominent archaeologists, Ruth Shady, was shot in the chest by land traffickers, who were actively trying to take over the lands by Caral, like the earliest civilization in the Americas have been threatened by these land traffickers for decades. For decades. I mean, the Peru's most notorious. This woman's out here making the most incredible finds in the world, and like she didn't have the protection not to be shot by these land traffickers. It's insane.
That's insane. So it's like basically you just got like kind of cowboy cartel corporations that are bullying their way onto land, and they don't really care about regulation or history at all.
And so it's and for me it makes my mission a bit more pressing, so to speak, because what you were seeing at those sites. The cartels, they're not documenting what was there. You know what I mean? We literally just lost an archaeological site. It's just gone. You know, there's no record of what was there. Whatever artifacts may have been there are now on some black market somewhere. And so we really miss out. And the way I think about things is you never know how this site connected with that site or that site connected with this or what celestial alignments might have been. And now the site's not even there. If we didn't even know it was there, we're missing out on all this potential information. So my personal goal is to do the hard work and make it out to these sites, document what's there, create these 3D models, put them on a map for future generations so these connections don't get lost. You know, I don't want to be all like call to action type of stuff, but like time is of the essence. It's just happening. Within the past 2 years, these sites are no longer there, you know?
Absolutely. And that's an applaudable mission, you know, trying to get out to these areas and actually preserve it for future generations and to try and understand it. Because at the end of the day, if you don't do that, this is just going to happen again and again and again. And we'll be much worse off for it.
If you believe in this work and find value in it, consider helping to support the next expedition, because every little bit helps.
Well, not many people are out there trying to do that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you come across someone who's actually got, you know, the energy and the drive to do very difficult things, actually go out to these wild areas of Peru and document it, it's admirable and people want to see it. And, you know, I know that my audience is going to definitely appreciate the kind of work you're doing, so I'll definitely recommend everyone please go over to Pillars of the Past and click on that link, give them a subscribe if you can, sign up for Patreon, because we both need that support. This is how we fund expeditions, this is how we get out to these places. You know, I think Raul's working as a one-man band just like myself, so at the end of the day it's you guys that support us and actually help us get out to these places so we can do the documenting and the work. So it's greatly appreciated. Do you want to hear a really weird UFO story from Peru?
Yeah, absolutely.
someone sent this to me because they said that I should get in contact with this guide that they met in Peru for a number of years. And his name is Juan Miranda from Cusco. I'm going to tell you the story. This is pretty interesting. Who knows if it's true or not, but interesting. And he said, you have to meet Juan and ask him to take you out to this valley. So he said, I met Juan Miranda, a local Cusco guide, when I was on tour of the sacred sites. He told me stories of a canyon way off the tourist track where UFO activity has been seen. So after the tour was done, I stayed on and hired Juan to take me out there. We had to take a local bus and then walk for a day to get there, and we camped overnight. I saw multiple single white lights in the canyon moving around, but couldn't say they were craft. No roads, no power anywhere nearby, and it was silent at night, so you could hear dogs barking, echoing from many kilometers away. Then I noticed three red dots in a triangle shape beneath the cliff we were standing on, hovering below us deeper in the canyon. It was moving like those fake UFOs do in the videos, where it's almost like it's dangling on a string. Then the big kicker was another white light that seemed to have a spotlight come out of it and scan the ground on the other side of the canyon. There was no noticeable audio, so it couldn't have been any conventional vehicle that I know of. The locals freaked out and took off back to the camp. Juan stayed, as he's used to it, and I did as well. Starting to get nervous, I forced myself to sit down so I didn't run and miss out finding what happened next. Then the spotlight seemed to point directly at where we were sitting at a distance to communicate it was aware of us watching it. Then the spotlight switched off and the craft moved back behind the mountain opposite us, and I saw what I can only describe as a portal-like glow and flash as it moved out of our direct line of sight and apparently portaled away. Juan told me he's seen metallic craft fly past within 20 meters of him on that cliff, has also seen them fly into the mountain, and he believes they have a base there somehow.